Hello, welcome everyone. Sorry for the inconvenience. We're having a little bit of microphone difficulties, but we will have this resolved really quickly. In the meantime, we'll just use this handheld, and I want to welcome everyone for coming. So at this time, I would like to introduce to the podium Mr. Bruce Bustamante, who is a board member of the Alaska World Affairs Council. You might know him as the president of the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce, and he is going to introduce our speakers today. Bruce. Testing, testing, testing. That doesn't work.
Oh, I think we are on. Can you hear me in the back? Great. Well, thank you very much. Okay, yeah, you can have this one back. Well, thank you very much, Lisa, for the nice introduction, also for the opportunity to be part of this program today. And, you know, let's look across the audience, including Tara and Tommy Baker. I see a lot of friends that we work with at the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce with our military events. And so we've got, you know, a few big events coming up in June, which is part of our Military Appreciation Week. So this is a great connection to today's program and certainly to the military. And we certainly appreciate the support we get from those individuals and also everyone here in the room that's involved with that. As Lisa mentioned, it is my pleasure to introduce our speakers, so I'll go ahead and get started. First, I'd like to introduce General Joe Ralston. General Ralston served in the nation's second highest ranking military position as Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He also served as Commander of U.S. European Command and Commander of NATO. General Ralston is known to many Alaskans as the former Commander of the Alaskan Command and the Alaskan NORAD region. As a Commander of the U.S. European Command from 2000 to 2003, General Ralston was the senior U.S. military officer and commander of all U.S. forces in an area of responsibility that covers more than 21 million square miles and includes 93 nations. This territory extends from the North Cape of Norway through the waters of the Baltic and Mediterranean seas, most of Europe, parts of the Middle East, and to the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa. And I have to say, I had the pleasure, I know I shared this with General Ralston at an earlier meeting too, when he was commander of NATO, to get a briefing while we were in London as part of a trade mission with Governor Tony Knowles. And when he was explaining the level of responsibility that he had and his people had, it was just amazing. And what a tremendous honor and opportunity to hear that briefing. He led the command in daily missions in the war against terrorism from the streets of Bosnia to the waters of the Mediterranean. And he oversaw air operations in the no-fly zone of northern Iraq. Let's please give General Joe Ralston a big round of applause. Joining General Ralston today is Lieutenant General Ken Wilsbach, and he is the senior military officer in Alaska responsible for the integration of all military activities in the Alaskan Joint Operations Area, synchronizing the activities of more than 21,000 active duty and reserve forces from all services. He is also responsible for the planning and execution of all homeland defense operations within the theater, including security and civil support actions. Lieutenant General Wilsbach also commands 11th Air Force, overseeing the training and readiness of five wings and Air Force installations located in Alaska, Hawaii, and Guam. As commander of the Alaska region of the North American Aerospace Defense Command, Lieutenant Wilsbach directs operations to ensure effective surveillance, monitoring, and defense of the region's airspace. He also was commissioned in 1985 as a distinguished graduate of the University of Florida's ROTC program and earned his pilot's wings in 1986 at Laughlin Air Force Base. So you have Florida in your NCAA bracket, I'm sure, going all the way. All right. He is a command pilot with more than 3,800 hours in multiple aircraft, primarily in the F-15C, MC-12, and F-22A, and has flown in 71 combat missions in operations Northern Watch, Southern Watch, and Enduring Freedom. Please join me in welcoming Lieutenant General Ken Wilsbach. Gentlemen.
Bruce, thank you very much for that, and great to be with all of you here with the Rural Affairs Council today. And I see many friends from years past here, and great to be with all of you again. I'm going to try to keep my remarks pretty short here and talk a little bit about the history of the military in Alaska. And then General Wilsbach is going to talk about the military presently and where it's going in the future. If I could sum it up, my one point for the day is that higher headquarters have never understood the military in Alaska and Alaska's strategic position. And to illustrate that, I'll give you a couple of stories. During the time that I was here, 25 years ago, by the way, I felt especially blessed to have been befriended by so many great Alaskan men and women who actually built this state, who were here pre-World War II. I'm talking about Bob Atwood, Mr. Alaska, his wife Evangeline, who founded the Alaska Rural Affairs Council, for example. Augie Hebert, who brought radio and television to Alaska. Elmer Rasmussen, Dan Cuddy in the banking business to do it. Governor Hickel. These were all people who lived through World War II and before that here in Alaska. They were very close friends with Lieutenant General Simon Buckner, who was the commander of Alaskan Command during the Second World War. And I've listened to their stories for years, along with Brigadier General Ben Talley, who General Talley lived down at Anchor Point during the time that I was here. And the one thing that came through loud and clear is the frustration that General Buckner had with Washington in 1940, trying to convince them that we needed to increase the defenses in Alaska because Japan was going to go to war against the United States. Nobody in Washington wanted to hear that or listen to that. To show you how engaged he was, 1 week before Pearl Harbor, General Buckner put every military person in Alaska on the highest state of alert because he knew what was coming, but he couldn't get anybody in Washington to listen to that. General Talley was a colonel, Army colonel at the time, and he was General Buckner's engineer. And General Buckner was constantly beating on Colonel Talley to build air bases down the Aleutian chain because we knew we were going to need those bases when war came. And he couldn't get any money. He told me he went back to Washington, and this is before there was a Pentagon. He had to go all over Washington to every office in Washington trying to get some money to build air bases down the Aleutian chain. He told me that finally, to get rid of him, they agreed to give him $243,000 in a fund site. That was barely enough to build one base. So General Talley said on his way back to Alaska, he made the decision that he was going to spend that same $243,000 time and time again. He was going to use the same fund site to build every base. He says, "They'll catch me someday, but if we go to war, they'll forgive me." And he was exactly right. So he built all the air bases down the Aleutian chain using the same fund site for the same $243,000. But the point was, nobody in Washington would listen. As time goes on, to add to that, let me go back further in history. When I was commander of NATO, Dee Dee and I were in Brussels one night at a very fancy dinner party. And Dee Dee was at a different table from me, and she came over and she says, "There's a lady at my table that I would like for you to talk to." So I went over and introduced myself, and there was this very sophisticated European lady who says, "I've always wanted to go to Alaska." And I said, "Well, why have you always wanted to go to Alaska?" She said, "Well, my great-great-grandfather was the Russian governor of Alaska." I said, "Really? Which one?" She said, "Governor Wrangell. You know, we've got the Wrangell Mountains and Wrangell Island and the town of Wrangell." And she gave me what I considered to be a real treasure. And it was a series of reports that her great-great-grandfather had sent back to the Russian Tsar while he was governor in Alaska. And it's very, very much like the reports that I sent back, or General Case sent back, or General Wilsbach is now sending back to higher headquarters. St. Petersburg didn't understand and would never give him a positive response. Governor Rangel was a very interesting guy. He was a Russian naval officer. In 1925, he went out as an ensign on a Russian expedition. He got back home 4 years later, which they considered to be great success since he found his way back home. And he had great potential. So the powers that be says, we've got a new assignment for you. You're going to be the governor of Alaska. That wasn't exactly what he wanted to hear, but he took 30 days leave, went home, met this young girl, got married, and hauled her off to Sitka, Alaska. It took a year to get there, all across Siberia, finally got to Anadyr, got on a boat at Anadyr, and got to Sitka. Mrs. Rangel was the first non-native woman in Alaska, and she's widely credited with bringing civilization to Sitka. Wonderful stories in those reports, and I'll show you one of the, how he was thinking ahead. He finally got one positive response back from the Tsar. This was in 1835. It was time for him to go back to Russia. And he wrote the Tsar with his plan. He says, I want to go to Mexico and meet with the Mexican leader and cut a deal that if Mexico will recognize Russia's right to California, Russia will recognize Mexico's independence from Spain and Mexico's right to Texas. And the Tsar told him, okay, go ahead. So he's on his boat, he goes to Mexico, and while he is en route, the Mexican leader dies. He gets to Mexico, there's nobody to talk to because they're in a state of mourning. But think how history could have been changed if that had gone through at that time in 1835. After Governor Rangel went back to Russia, he became the Secretary of the Navy ultimately, and in 1867 was vociferous in his opposition to the Tsar selling Alaska to the United States. But again, unsuccessful. But anyway, my point is the stories, whether it was 187 years ago or whether it was 77 years ago when General Buckner was here, or today, it's a constant effort to try to explain the situation in Alaska to our respective higher headquarters. One last story on that. General Buckner, after he left Alaska, went to Okinawa, and he was killed in the Battle of Okinawa. He was the highest ranking military officer in World War II to be killed by enemy action. Back to Bob Atwood, in 1994, I took a civic leaders group to Okinawa. And one of the things that was particularly meaningful to me was Bob Atwood considered Simon Buckner his best friend, and Bob asked if I could take him to where Simon Buckner was killed. And we did. But again, back to the, I didn't talk about Augie Hebert. Back to the relationship again between the civilian leadership in Alaska and the military. This is December 7, 1941. Augie Hebert is at the radio station in Fairbanks. And over the teletype, he received word that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. Augie was the first to notify General Buckner that Pearl Harbor had been attacked. And that's the relationship between the civilian leadership in Alaska and the military Alaska during all this time period. So I'm going to sit down and let General Wilsbach talk about what's going on today, and then we'll have time for questions and answers if you want to follow up on any of that later on. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, everybody. It's really good to be here. Lise, thanks so much for inviting me. I was telling Lisa earlier that she's patient and both persistent, because when I first took command in August, she approached me about coming to a lunch and speaking, and it's taken from then until now to get General Ralston and my schedules lined up so we were actually both here at the same time on a Friday. So thanks for having us. Bruce, thanks so much for the very kind introduction, and General Ralston, thanks for your words. I have known General Ralston happened since I was a first lieutenant. He probably doesn't even remember this, but I got to meet him one time in headquarters at Langley Air Force Base, and I've always considered him an American hero and really a legend of air power. And it's really kind of intimidating to follow you as a speaker, so I'll just lay that out up front. I often say this to Alaska audiences, and I want to reiterate it here just in case you haven't heard me say this, but military members have such a great privilege to serve here in Alaska, and it's why a lot of us come here and then stay. It's this sentiment. And you get some of this in other places, but there's one part that's unique to Alaska, and you don't get it anywhere else. And so many places you go where you serve, the community around the base will say, hey, we appreciate what y'all are doing. Hey, we really support the mission that you all are executing from here. And so we have that in Alaska, but then in Alaska what you also get is, oh, you're coming to my house for Thanksgiving. Oh, no, my family's coming over for Christmas Eve, and you're coming too. Okay, so that's different in Alaska, and it's why people love to serve here and why they also love to stay. You should have a graphic on your table that looks something like this. And I'm going to refer to it in my remarks throughout my little speech here. And I'd like for you to consider where you're at. And look at the left side of that globe. It's a globe, and it shifted the globe so that you're looking at the globe from above, or what some people think is above. But it puts Alaska in the center of the globe. And that yellow circle represents 9.5 hours of flying time from either Anchorage or Fairbanks. At about 0.8 Mach, which is about what you travel on when you're on Alaska Airlines. And so what it tells you is that from that point, from this point in the world, you can be in almost every capital in the Northern Hemisphere. You can get down into South America. And because you have to go through Seattle or Denver or Los Angeles and wait 2 or 3 hours for a flight, you know, you don't really realize how quick you can get to places from Alaska. But it's exactly why Alaska is such a strategic location. And going back to what General Ralston talked about, which people don't understand that, the people from the lower latitudes, they don't get this. They don't realize how centrally located Alaska is to the rest of the world. And when you take Alaska and the ability for us to put forces out into the world, whether it's to project power or for humanitarian assistance, it's clearly a very, very strategic location. In addition, because it's centrally located, it's also a place that we need to protect. And so one of my missions here is to defend the airspace, and we partner with all the joint forces here in Alaska to do that, while we also partner up with Canada to protect this great nation of ours, because we are so close to many of the threats, which I'll address here in a bit. So if you'll take a look at that graph again, and you'll go to the bottom center, the Arctic is a changing environment, and so the white represents, and this is mostly a summertime picture, but the white represents where the ice is now, and the red outline is where it used to be a few years ago. And so what you can see is there's a lot of ice that isn't there anymore, and it's opened up some transit lanes. And if you shift to the right-hand portion of that slide, bottom right, you can see some of those transit lanes. And so the Arctic is open up to transit just for the same reason that we use Great Circle routes to fly around the globe. Global mariners like to do the same thing when they travel on the ocean. It saves them time and money, and they can get their goods and services back and forth across the world easier. In addition, we're seeing tourism open up. We saw the Crystal Serenity even last year in the Arctic. And of course, we all know about the natural resources, both fish and oil and gas and that sort of thing. And so there's a lot of nations that are interested. And in fact, the top right of that chart, you can see all the nations who claim at least have claims in the Arctic, and some of them overlap. Now, here's the good news. The good news is that up to this point, all of the claims, even though they overlap, have been settled, or at least we've agreed to disagree peacefully, and we've used diplomacy to be able to solve, or at least put to rest some of the differences, and that's the way we would like to keep it. Of course, the United States has a Arctic strategy, and there's a few key points in that strategy that Alaskans should be aware of, and I'm sure you are, but we want a stable and secure Arctic region. We want to be a safe place so that our interests can be realized, and our partners that use that that space on the globe can also have the same benefits. There's two key things that I think are important to remember here is that we want to ensure that, so we want to have a posture here in Alaska as the Arctic state, and we have many partners, for example, Canada and many other nations around the world that that we're partnered with and have interest in the Arctic. And then we also want to be globally minded, even though we're kind of on one part of the globe, but those are two key things. And so I think about how do we do this from the military standpoint, and what does that mean to us here in Alaska? And I'll say the first one is training. And we that are stationed here in Alaska have such a great benefit for training. Many of you are familiar with the JPARC, the Joint Alaska Range Complex, which is the largest training complex that we have in the United States. And in fact, it's when you take the size and the quality of that range space, it allows Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marines to train in an overland. And there's an overwater part of that as well. It's larger than the state of Florida. You can't get that anywhere else. In fact, our next really competitive airspace to what we have here in Alaska is near Las Vegas in Nevada. And General Ralston and I have both had plenty of time flying on the ranges around Nellis. Our range space here is 6 times larger than that range space. And so as we go to fifth generation aircraft like the F-22 and the F-35, that really require those spaces to be able to ring out the systems in that aircraft and really develop the tactics, techniques, and procedures to use those aircraft properly, you need that space. In addition, we have countries from all over the world that come to Alaska to participate in exercises like Northern Edge, which we'll be executing here in May, and then we have Red Flag Alaska. This is the high-end fight that we practice, and so we get fifth-gen aircraft. But we also get our partners from around the world. This year we should have South Korea and Japan here. Last year we had 16 other nations that came right here to Alaska. And they get to have the best training that they've probably ever had in their careers, and they always want to come back because it's such high-quality training. And so that does a couple of things for us. One, it ups their game. But then if we ever have to go do something with them somewhere in the world where there's a contingency, they're interoperable because they've trained with us here in a training environment. And so I'd like to thank the citizens of Alaska for the opportunity to have great training opportunities. The other thing that I think is really important toward realizing our Arctic strategy is investments. And I think that you're going to see, as I quote some of these numbers here, that while I still have to do a lot of this, take this chart around and explain it to people, especially in Washington, General Ralston. They're starting to get it, and you'll know that by where the money's going, and you're going to see that here in a second. But one of the great investments that you're seeing here is our F-35 installation in Eielson Air Force Base. The jets are going to actually start here in 2022, and our full complement of 54 jets should be here by, start in 2020 and then end up in 2022. That should effectively double the size of Eielson Air Force Base, about 3,500 additional personnel. In the meantime, though, the base, it's a new mission for the base, and so we're going to have to actually do quite a bit of construction here over the next few years. It's in excess of $500 million just in construction at Eielson Air Force Base for the F-35. But bringing it back closer to right now, just this year, about $500 million is being spent in Alaska in this year, not just for Eielson, but throughout the state. And in fact, Alaska's the number one state for spending for DOD. So in fact, we're leading by $124 million. So that's the next closest state. So I guess we're we're getting through to somebody, General Ralston, so that's all very, very good. And so as I get to the end of my remarks here, and we'll take some questions here in a little bit, I would like to tell you what's on my scope. Okay, and so that's an airman term because we watch the radar scope while we're flying. But these are the things that I pay very close attention to and that I'm spending a lot of my time working on. My number one priority is homeland defense. And so you know we have aircraft on alert both here at J-Bear as well as at Eielson. And we've got airmen and Air National Guardsmen watching scopes from radars that are all over the state, and we pay attention to the airspace. We're teamed up with Canada, and we're defending the airspace. The next thing we're taking a very close look at is Russia. Now, we talked a little bit about the Arctic, and we want it to be peaceful. But one of the things about Russia that we're taking a very close look at is their military buildup that's Arctic capable. And we have Arctic capable military forces, but what concerns me is Russia's building offensive Arctic capability, like Arctic capable amphibious units, and they're stationing a number of brigades in the Arctic region that are new to them. You have to wonder and ask yourself, what are those for? And so we want to make sure that we keep the Arctic peaceful. And so that has me watching. China is using those Arctic routes as well. And we've all seen some of the activity that's going on with China in the East China Sea and the South China Sea. North Korea. I mean, you don't have to go any farther than the noontime news to be concerned about North Korea, their nuclear aspirations, as well as their ICBM aspirations as well. And those ICBMs will certainly, you know, if they are successful in completing their test program and they made it up with a nuclear weapon, they can put at risk the continental United States and certainly Alaska. Which is why our radars that are at Shimmy as well as Clear are very important to detect that, and then our ground-based interceptors that are over at Fort Greely that can intercept those missiles are so important to us here in Alaska as well. Iran. You know, a lot of people, we were talking about, are you going to bring up the Middle East? Yes, I'm going to bring up the Middle East two times here. So we don't think about Iran as being a threat to Alaska, but if you take a look at this globe and you find Iran, if you know your geography and you draw a line between Iran and, say, Los Angeles, look where the route takes you. It's almost directly over Alaska. And so those ground-based interceptors I was talking about a bit ago, those will be a factor. And then the last threat that we're paying attention to is violent extremist organizations. And of course, we have airmen from Alaska deployed downrange. In fact, General Ralston was just talking to the commander of the forces in the UAE just a few days ago. And we are taking it to the enemy. In fact, last week, F-22s from right here in Alaska had 11 engagements against ISIS. And by engagements, that's a polite way of saying we drop bombs on them. And so they learned how to do that right here in Alaska on the J-Park complex. And again, I'd like to just thank everybody for providing that opportunity for them. The third thing that we're really paying attention to is Arctic advocacy. And so typically, myself and my Army and National Guard and Coast Guard counterparts here in Alaska, we are DOD's expert on Alaska. And so I get called to many meetings, and we're the ones that people listen to. And so I would like to thank the group here, as well as many other people that we interact with here in Alaska, to educate me so that I can be that expert to advocate for Alaska and the Arctic. Certainly, being ready to fight tonight is my fourth priority, and so that goes right back to the training. And it's not just here, but it's also the forces that we have in Hawaii and Guam. And if you take Hawaii, Alaska, and Guam, and you make a triangle out of it, I call that the nation's strategic triangle, because from those three points, we can force project whether it's for in anger or whether it's for humanitarian assistance or disaster. disaster assistance, we can force project without asking permission, because all three of those locations are U.S. territories. If we go to places like Korea and Japan, we always have to ask the host nation, and so that gives us a little bit of a leg up when we don't have to go through some of the diplomacy. We can go straight to a decision. And then the last thing that I'm paying attention to is taking care of families, and so we have people downrange. When people come to Alaska, as you all know, many times they come here and they didn't know anything about Alaska. They're a long way from home, and so we want to take care of those families. And one thing that you can help me on, as I talked about bringing the F-35 into Eielson, and we're going to have about 3,500 additional people, several hundred families, we need some houses in North Pole and Fairbanks. And so for your friends that build houses and apartments and condos, we need some. So if you can spread that word, we'll take your help. Well, let me just conclude and tell you that I'm very happy to be able to serve here in Alaska. It is an extremely important strategic location for our nation. I think that with the investment that our nation is making in Alaska, it's a clear signal that we are starting to make some inroads into people that aren't from here that realize that it is an important place and that we can do some really good work from here. And so we're seeing the money flow in here, which is a great thing. Thank you again for supporting the men and women that serve here, and I look forward to your questions. Thank you very much.
I want to thank the generals for their great presentation, and they have left some time for questions from the audience. If you wouldn't mind raising your hand and waiting for the microphone to come to you, because it is being recorded for the radio. And do we see the microphone?
Yeah. Thank you both for being here. So my question is in regards to the issue of icebreakers. As I understand it, the United States is in possession of only one operable icebreaker, and it was built in 1976. Now, I know I was reading an article just now. There's some chatter in Congress last year about building a new one. However, Lockheed Martin, the main contractor for it, quoted something close to $1 billion and a 10-year construction cycle. Now, given that Russia has, I think, a few more than we do, operable. Do you think that this is a worthy investment for the United States in the long term? Thanks.
Okay.
Let me try it from up here. Can you hear me okay? The question was icebreakers. Yes, the United States has two icebreakers, one of which is operable and is very old, as you point out. Russia, at the same time, I think has something close to 40 icebreakers, including their newest one is a nuclear-powered icebreaker. Now, I am not slamming Russia for having a nuclear-powered icebreaker. I think the United States ought to have icebreakers as well, because there's enough reason to have icebreakers as the ice melts and you get more transportation, you get all the things that are going to be happening in the Arctic. You're going to need the Coast Guard, and the Coast Guard is going to need to be equipped to do that. The cost of a ship today is mind-boggling. I think the latest Navy carrier, I think, is $13 billion for a carrier. So $1 billion for an icebreaker compared to $13 billion is a bargain. I don't know what an icebreaker would cost, but it's going to be expensive. Let me talk for a moment about the budget, because that's ongoing. And I don't mean for my comments to sound political today. I'm going to give you my best personal judgment on where things are going. When people talk about a budget, you have to be careful what year you're talking about, because we are always dealing with three budget years. We are 1 week away from being halfway through fiscal year 17. We do not yet have a defense appropriations for fiscal year 17. We're operating under a continuing resolution until the 28th of April. Who knows what will happen at the end of that time period. In the meantime, you can't spend any more money than you spent last year, and you can't have any new starts. the fiscal year 18 budget, which should have been delivered to the Hill the first week of February, has not yet been done. That's not unusual. Anytime you have a new administration coming in, they normally take an extra 90 days to try to modify the budget that they had received that had been worked on for a year. But if we're lucky, sometime in May, the fiscal year 18 budget will get to the Hill. And in the meantime, the services are working on fiscal year 19 budget, trying to put that together, and the services will have to have that done here in a couple of months. In addition, the administration has said readiness is a real problem among the services, and they have submitted a fiscal year 17 supplemental budget of $30 billion. That is just to fix some of the readiness issues that are involved in fiscal year 17. So you've got at least four budgets circulating out there. I personally am not very optimistic that there is going to be the increase in defense that people talk about. Number one, the fiscal year 18 top line budget, which you have read in the paper, is supposed to be $54 billion increase. Well, you have to be careful what you're increasing it over, because in reality it's $17 billion more than the Obama administration budget for FY18. That's about 3%. That'll just about keep pace with inflation. And the chances of that happening, I think, are pretty slim, because you're going to have to change the Budget Control Act and a lot of things that are going to be difficult that you need 60 votes in the Senate to do. So, long answer to your question, but I think icebreakers are important. I think it's something that we need to advocate for. It is not a hostile act to have icebreakers for the Arctic. We need it for commerce, we need it for search and rescue, we need it for oil spill response, all of the various things that we need to do. I think it's going to be a long time in coming, as you say, maybe even a decade. If you got started and if you had the money, you're a decade away from having the icebreaker. Sorry.
So yesterday, we actually were talking with Rear Admiral Mike McAllister, who's the District 17 Coast Guard commander, which has the responsibility for Alaskan waters, and we were talking about icebreakers, and he did report that the Coast Guard has in their budget in the upcoming years an icebreaker that looks like it's going to go forward. It's going to take about 3 years to build. The fact is that our shipbuilding infrastructure in the United States is such that it takes that long to build one icebreaker, so it's just one. The Coast Guard's on record saying that their requirement is for six, three heavies and three medium. And what that allows us to do is all the things that General Ralston was talking about. So it allows you to keep both the Arctic waters and the Antarctic waters open for both commerce and for all those other activities. But one is what we're going to get. Six is what we think we need.
It's very difficult for lay people to know what to believe nowadays, but I've heard recently that the United States military equipment is 50% approximately non-functional because of need for spare parts and need for maintenance. It sounds quite alarming and quite dangerous. Is that approximately true?
Take that one. So I can tell you that the forces under my command are at a much higher rate than that. So our aircraft generally are about 80% or higher ready. There are some gaps for being underfunded over the last several years. And so there are, I was talking to some Marine friends last week, and they've got some significant gaps, and especially their F-18 force that are approaching the number that you talked about. But for the Air Force, you may have read some of the news just even as early as, I think, Wednesday or Thursday. Our Vice Chief was saying that there are significant gaps that we need some additional funding to make up for several years.
years of underfunding to the point where our forces aren't as ready, mainly in the maintenance and sustainability. You know, recall that our Air Force has gotten about half the size it was 20 years ago, and yet we have just as many, maybe even more missions. And so not only do we have fewer people, we have fewer equipment, and we're running that equipment much harder. And so if you keep doing that over time, your readiness tends to go backwards, and so it will take funding. But for the 11th Air Force readiness, we're about 80%.
Sir, if you received a credible attack notice on the U.S., how quickly is your response to getting people in planes? How quickly does that happen?
We already have people in place, so we've got people that are working 24/7 on alert, and so it depends on the type of attack, depends on what kind of attack it is. But I can tell you that we're talking seconds for something like a ballistic missile, and we're talking minutes for an aircraft or a cruise missile. I can't go into the specifics because I start to get into classified information, but what I can tell you is we have people that are sitting alert 24/7 inside of Alaska, and that I also have forces in Hawaii and Guam that are doing the same. And then from there, if there was an attack, we would bolster the amount of people that are on alert very, very quickly. In the order of about 24 hours, we would have everybody recalled and they would be in place to fight.
Generals, just a quick question on, as far as sovereignty goes, you said that most of the issues are solved as regard to the map there. How big, and this is a legitimate question, not baiting or anything, how important is search and rescue to establishing your sovereignty over a geographic area, and do people understand that?
The question was, how important is search and rescue from an air sovereignty or from a sovereignty point of view to do that? You know, search and rescue is very, very important for the United States military for a whole host of reasons. Number one, you have, in the case of the Coast Guard, that's one of their primary missions is for search and rescue. Even here in the Arctic, search and rescue goes way beyond maritime, and as you know, we've got the Air National Guard very well equipped here in Alaska to do search and rescue, not only at home but around the world. One of the things that I think we ought to be doing more of in trying to reach out and to have some cooperative effort with the Russians is in search and rescue. One of the things that I was privileged to do in 1993 was to lead the first exercise from Alaska since the breakup of the Soviet Union to Russia. And we took the Alaska National Guard, C-5s, helicopters, C-130s, and we went off to Tiksi, Russia, 72 degrees north latitude, further north than Barrow. And we conducted the first SAR-X, search and rescue exercise. It was non-confrontational. It's something everybody could agree to. It was humanitarian. And the theory was an airliner has gone down over the Arctic, and how are you going to rescue the people that are there? That exercise lasted for a number of years between Alaskan Command, the Canadians, and Russia. Unfortunately, the political situation deteriorated to the point that we've been unable to do that for the last few years, but I think it's something that we ought to be looking at and trying to establish a way to have a cooperative relationship with our neighbors.
One good news about that, as General Rawlson rightly said, we're not allowed to do military-to-military cooperation with the Russians because of the political situation. But the Coast Guard, in a non-military way, actually does do some Alaska Coast Guard to Russian cooperation, and so they get a lot out of that. And the Russians and the Coast Guard talk daily, and especially on the Bering Sea, especially when it comes to fishery management and that sort of thing. So there is some cooperation between the U.S. and Russia in a positive way with search and rescue.
Thank you. General, you mentioned a lot about Fairbanks and Eielson and $500 million being spent in 3,500 families, which is great for our friends and neighbors in Fairbanks, but my question is pretty provincial, and that is, what do you expect or anticipate or hope for in terms of expansion of physical plant and or people here at J-Bear?
Yeah, so I don't anticipate a lot of expansion of people here at J-Bear. There was some talk about the Army downsizing. That talk is over. So what I'm hearing from my Army counterpart is the 425 is going to stay in place as you see it today. So not a downsizing by the 425. So that's good. As far as infrastructure improvements, probably the biggest one at J-Bear for this next year is a new hangar for the AWACS facility. It's about a $29 million hangar facility. And so, and then, of course, you know, the facilities on the base are constantly being renovated. And so, you know, there's small projects all over the base, hundreds of them. Another major project that I am working on that's out in the future is expanding the short runway. So, you know, the long runway's about 10,000 feet. The short one's about 8,000 feet. I'd like to add about 1,500 or 2,000 feet to that short runway. Because when we do maintenance on the short run, the long runway, the short one's too short when the weather's bad. And so we miss out on some of our missions, especially when the runway is wet. So if I have two 10,000 footers, I never have to worry about which runway is open or closed. It helps out with the traffic around here too. That'd be a very big project. Way early to start licking your chops if you're a contractor, because I don't have a contract on it yet. But that's something that I really have put up to my bosses as something I want to do at J-Bear to expand the capability of the base.
This will be the
if
last
I
could
just
question.
Add to that, 8,000 feet sounds like a long runway, but I can tell you from experience, landing on that runway in the wintertime, it needs to be longer. Good luck.
So this is the last question.
Sir, you've made reference to Canada as an ally, and I'm just curious, what role would they take on if we were to experience an attack from either Russia, North Korea, China, or any of the people that you mentioned?
So without getting into Canadian politics, I'll try to stay away from maybe a lot of your question, which is I would have to say for China and North Korea, I don't really know, but I can tell you about Russia, we certainly have an agreement. It's a binational agreement for the defense of North America, and in fact, when we exercised this, we just exercised it a few weeks ago. Where the attack is coming through the Arctic, and sometimes it goes through Canadian airspace, and sometimes it goes through U.S. And in fact, U.S. fighters will go into Canada and defend their airspace, and vice versa. So you'll have Canadian fighters coming into U.S. airspace, and we have the arrangement to cooperate in that way. In addition, while those fighters are airborne, the Canadian F-18s might get refueled by an Eielson KC-135 or maybe even a KC-135 that's based out of Washington State. And so that happens all the time, every day. And so we have our procedures fairly well set. When it gets to some of those other countries that you mentioned, I'm not really sure because it goes into Canadian politics. But I think the Russia piece is pretty well straightened out.
Let me add one thing that we sometimes forget. And General Rosenbach talks very much about NORAD and the binational agreement that we've got with Canada. But don't forget that Canada is also a member of NATO. And any attack against any NATO nation, from wherever it comes, is considered an attack against all. When 9/11 happened, we always thought that American forces or Canadian forces would deploy to Europe to defend Europe. Well, ironically, the only time Article 5 has ever been implemented in the history of NATO was on 9/11, and it was European AWACS airplanes that came to the United States to defend Washington, D.C., New York City, and other major cities for many, many months. So, to answer your question, if there was an attack against the United States, Canada, under its NATO obligations under Article 5, would be with the United States.
If you
could all join me in thanking our speakers today.